Blog Talk Radio.
It's been 1 week, you look at me. Do you love me? Yeah, you're crazy. 5 days, you tackle me. I still got the reference, I'm so funny. It's been 3 days since the afternoon. You realize it's not my fault, but I'm too soon. Say, you've forgiven me. And now I'll sit back and wait till you say you're sorry. To the 2009 rendition of this dopey show, Soma Time.
Mm-hmm. Here we are.
I'm completely discombobulated here as we start the year. What have they done to my show? What have they done? I do see all the archives here. They call them now on-demand episodes instead of archive saves.
Oh, really? Wait, I didn't see that.
They're called on-demand episodes. And you know the demand for our episodes are so high.
Well, you never know.
Yeah, well.
How come I missed that?
You have to go to the new homepage, which now will not get there. Naked Soma has been eliminated from the cosmos. So we are now the former hosts of Naked Soma. I think it only counts for us to log in and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So you must put the / Soma Time to enter our little room. So there will be an update later on somaspace.org to make sure the connection is still there.
So I'm looking. Oh yeah, on demand episodes. Wow,
there you go.
Makes us sound special.
Like people care. Yeah.
Yeah. Previous episodes. How far back did they go when they switched us over here?
What, to this? I don't know. I guess it started on the first of the year.
No, I don't mean that. I mean,
what?
How many archives did they bring over? I'm looking.
All of it. May
they're all there, huh?
Yeah, they're all there. President accounted for, sir.
Wow.
Yeah.
Original air date. Oh, that makes us sound, I don't know, legitimate.
Well, we've done, I don't know, probably close to 80 of these suckers. The number to call to participate is still, I think, 646-478-4847. And we spent the last 2 weeks sifting through the bones, as it were, of the year 2008, which I want a merit badge for surviving.
Mm-hmm.
I would like that embroidered and put on my pantaloons, because last year, 2008, was a kick in the ass. It was a wake-up call on many levels. And so we started this adventure, Charlie, trying to get some common ground across between, sort of the world of the shrinkos, where you come from,
uh-huh,
and the world of the quackos, where I come from. You know? And we pretty much, you know, we exhausted just about every direction you could possibly go. Even going back as far as 2006 with the adventures of the Woo-a-Palooza, where all we said, I had a flashback today. What was that?
That was a frothy vomit.
Oh, what are you doing? Right off the bat, I'm sitting here trying to eat, goddammit.
Every time I hear about the Woo, I can't. I retch.
Well, I mean, that was September 8th and 9th, 2006, Woo-woo-palooza. I believe if you still Google it, it'll take you to something related to that event.
Yeah.
And basically, yeah, well, I think it's still up there in the sky somewhere, gathering moss. And basically, we were trying to get the unconventional practitioners, as we said, all the weird stuff that works, to show up and act like a community for a couple hours to sort of put a face to some of the modalities that people were dabbling with as they ran out of conventional ways to deal with their health and well-being. And it was an unmitigated disaster. Still think of that, those two sapes at in White Plains that were trying to advise us about the name and everything.
Oh, what was his name, Morty?
Morty and his other friend there, yeah. These two old Jewish guys.
Yeah, they were cute.
For, what was the outfit it was from? It was like some
Score.
Executive thing. Yeah, what's it called?
Score.
Score. I don't know.
It's the retired...
Executives.
Yeah.
And they were just thrown off by anything we said, you know. We haven't listened to any advice, really, that we've gotten in 2 years, but And those guys were really trying to help us, and they were just totally scared about everything we were talking about. And, you know, that was sort of the beginning of a series of unfortunate events that led to this show. here we are.
You couldn't have put it a better way. That was just beautiful.
It was like a dart through time, just, you know. And you know, no matter what we did, really, along the way, there was this sort of element of there must be some misunderstanding. Because the stuff that we have, we think is great. And anytime we talk to people in a small group where there's no filter, where there's no, you know, turnstile, where, you know, where there's just a conversation going on, and we get a lot of nodding heads, and people go, well, that's very interesting, very interesting. Well, we like what you have there. Indeed. What is their website, my sir? And then 2 seconds later, we get a lot of that, ouch, I'm thinking, and what, and let me get back to my regularly scheduled program. So we reduced and sort of streamlined our efforts here. In the last 2 weeks, we did the review shows, and you can go check them out there. It does it on demand over there on the Summertime homepage there.
Right.
And the thing is and actually it's still hanging over there on the blog we hate, on the dailyprofiler.net. It's still hanging in space. But we learned from all that stuff was that when we had simple and sort of engaging, entertaining type of concepts, you sapes would listen. When we had more complicated academic, researchy kind of stuff, you tuned the F out. And we slide to both sides of the street. I always remember recording those commercials over there at the Peak there.
Oh, that was so much fun.
There should have been a behind the scenes video of that.
Oh,
shortle.
I almost peed myself.
We were trying to advertise the Woo. You know, let me see if I have that here because that's a good way to.
I'm sure you do.
Yeah, it's somewhere up here. What an adventure that was. And whoever happened to that guy that was helping us out, who knows.
Who, Turtle?
Yeah, the poor bastard. No, not Turtle. The other guy that sold us the Space Turtle was just the techie.
Oh, I just came across his card today in my old wallet.
From the Peak?
Yeah.
What's
I bet it's in this pile right here. Let's see if I can find his name. That was Milhouse. I can't think of...
Milhouse.
Let me find his... Hey, Milhouse, I hope you're listening. David Sherman.
I'm sure he's out there. Shout out to David Sherman.
Hello, David.
Yeah, well, fabulous.
If we put blue hair on you, you would look a little bit like Milhouse.
Hmm. So let's see if we can revisit the summer of 2006 here, as it were. Again, we worked hard on these commercials.
Yeah.
It cost us a pretty penny, as I remember.
Ugh.
Get them out there to the FM crowd.
Yeah.
Let's see.
Hey, Val, you want to watch baseball this summer?
Yep, but I'm going to join a new team this fall.
What's the team's name?
Woo.
The team.
Woo.
The name of the team.
Relax, just go to woopalooza.com. It's all there.
Woopalooza.com?
Yeah, woopalooza.com.
Is there a number I can call? I'm in my car.
Forget about it. Just remember, woopalooza.com.
Okay, one more time. woopalooza.com.
Get your tickets now.
And Yankee fans, unlike A-Rod, you can't boo the Woo.
Not even for fun?
Nope, these MVPs deliver in the fall.
Hey, shut up. A timeless classic.
You know, it was worth every dime.
Well, for that, yes, yeah, so we can play our failures back on the radio show that nobody listens to 2 years
hysterical.
Later.
Hysterical. But we
tremendous.
Had so much fun doing that. I remember that I spelled woo-woo-palooza wrong on the website.
Yeah, well, that's amazing.
Nobody caught it until I sent it out to somebody, and they're like,
you spelled the site wrong.
Oh, that was so funny.
Thing was, we had a lot of interest in the event, but it was like it was all about the people that got involved. It was so obvious that there was no attempt to have any kind of community at all.
That was terrible.
Well, it just revealed a lot of the stuff we're going to be talking about on the show now. Is that in a way,
you know
a lot of the
hold on, just on that point, I'm just going to play this real quick.
Personally, I think the guy's a phony.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah. You know, now they have this new thing. The switchboard doesn't pop up. It's like a whole other page.
No, it's, well,
no, I gotta,
it always was, kind of.
Yeah, but now I can't even see it.
I see what you mean. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's right here. I'm looking at it.
Nightmare. These improvements are
pretty fleeting. Just have to get used to it.
No, I don't. So anyway, what is going on with this thing? I'm trying to get oriented here. So from that event and from the aftermath of that, we ended up wandering into this Blog Talk thing in 2007, and the effort was to try to use the format to sort of bridge the gap between what we call the woo, which would be the strange, unusual, kind of unconventional things that people do out there, that most people have a little bit of a, you know, just kind of a latent fear of. And the moo, the crap you use, it doesn't work, but you keep using it. You know, it could be mainstream or alternative, I don't really care. It just, it doesn't work. And the evidence is in your T-shirt, and you know it doesn't work. But you keep popping the drugs, doing the potions, the lotions, going to therapy, all the stuff we talk about here. So we kept saying, well, what's the common denominator here that a lot of people can just resonate with? And we got the hot idea, probably about a year and a half ago, that body language seemed to be coming up in conversation just about everywhere we went. And we said, well, we are from the Soma, which basically is the relationship of self and surroundings, and we will construct a clinic that will deal with that relationship, have a body language center. We'll discuss this body language with everyone. And everyone said, what? Ouch, I'm thinking. And they tuned out. So we had to literally steer the Queen Mary, after we had committed to going that direction, all the way around the yard, to talk about the identity issue that goes on in body language. So hence the phrase naked soma, the open identity. Again, lost on you, Sapes.
Love that.
And we went, it was great. And we spent, I don't know how much time and effort and money with that Dopey website with the naked soma and all that stuff. And it was just the whole year, 287. What was that guy's name, Jake?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow. God, I'm getting traumatized just thinking about all this. So that spearheaded us through into the fall, and we started interviewing authors and experts about all these different aspects of things that had to do with identity, had to do with your social identity, and our little system, our little lingo that nobody cared about called the Four Domains. Now, some but not all that stuff is over there on somaspace.org. Some of it's over on blogsoma.net. We have been spewing this little funky lingo every direction we can for the better part of 2 years now. Again, to no avail. You guys have the monkey ears, you know, with the hands over the ears, the eyes, and the mouth. You know, don't want to know nothing about it. So we said, all right, well, we can't keep pushing this thing. Well, we can, but it's not going anywhere. So we got to start figuring out how we can kind of back into it a little bit, kind of like ease you into the jacuzzi of what we're talking about here. Again, more revamping, more balloon animals, right? And we talked about that a little bit on the second half of the year review about how we changed formats a couple of times and tried to get things. I got to go on like Silver Show a couple of times. We got to go on some other shows, some political shows because of the campaign. And basically, we're trying to get past that third-person barrier that everybody uses when they discuss body language. They always do it from the outside in. It's always from this sort of unidentified observer that's uniform. And everybody's eyes, everybody's ears, everybody's perceptions are equal, and we're all just watching this other shape, like that skier that fell off the lift in Colorado.
Oh, how funny was that picture? The poor guy.
That could only happen to an eco.
Yeah, he had to be eco.
Yeah, dangling
no
from his foot, his pants around his ankles, and people snapping pictures
instead
of helping.
They are calling him the dangler, you know.
The dangler, that's
which
right.
Which is great in so many ways.
Well, hopefully he's in his late 40s. Hopefully he took it in stride. I would be forced to kill myself right after that happened.
You know, it's awfully cold out, too. That couldn't have helped matters at all.
The whole skiing thing. Obviously, he's a novice skier. I don't know if there's anything about that on the web, about you know, how many times he's been up that mountain. But it was a sad event, actually. He could have really been hurt.
Yeah.
Which is the, you know, the other side of it. But it just if you haven't heard about it, there was in SmokingGun.com over New Year's, as that happened on New Year's Day, I guess it said, an unidentified 48-year-old man riding the lift at the Blue Sky Basin wound up dangling by one ski, naked from the waist down, with a chair malfunction. Just that alone would cause, you know, most people to go, what?
Yeah.
And then it gets better because then he's dangling up there for, you know, an extended period of time. I think it was 15 minutes altogether before anyone came to help him. I mean, and of course, in this day and age of everybody with the cameras, they're snapping away at him. Well, he's dangling.
Yeah, that wasn't nice at all.
Well, this cheeky sight. Oh, God. So there was a child riding with him, had to cling to the upended seat until workers reversed the lift and rescued them several minutes later. So, you know, again, this common barrier of outside in, this third person thing, if you put yourself in that guy's shoes, you're not feeling as comfortable, ain't as funny, or if you're that kid. And there's been so much going on. There was a kid that stole their parent's car because they missed a bus, some six-year-old kid, and drove into a tree or something. I don't even know what's going on with
that. Oh, yeah, I heard that.
Yeah.
And the porn industry wants to be bailed out. So this
yeah,
is
I saw that. I can't wait to see that hearing. That should be great. The chair recognizes Seymour Butts. tremendous. What the heck do they need a bailout for? They're making more money than God.
Apparently,
7 minutes he was suspended up there.
That's a long, long time.
That would be like an eternity. And then the photographer that lost his job from the Vail Daily. The paper ran a revealing photo that has gone viral, and many readers have complained. That guy was so white it blinded me. The glare of the TV screen when I saw it on the evening news.
Oh, boy.
Obama should be more careful when he takes up a sport he knows nothing about, was the other comment I saw. Anyway, so again, this common ground of body language that everybody has some take on. You could flip on Bill O'Reilly, and he's got some sape yapping about it. There's a lot of talk about it on the political shows and the Sunday mornings. Any sports analysis you look at, they're always looking at the guy's body language. It's inherent in almost every conversation that I see in the popular press, and I'm sick of it. I'm sick of this, and I'm sick of you. So I said, okay, new year. We've gone through just about every way we can possibly fail to reach your ears. Let's try something that maybe we have a little thing to say about. So hence the new format this year. We're going to be looking at body language from the somatic vantage point. And in a couple of weeks, we haven't confirmed this yet, we will be shifting to the 10 o'clock hour. To piggyback on the new fancy show on Fox called Lie to Me, which is based on Paul Ekman's work in reading emotional cues in people's faces. The guy, what was his name, Timothy Roth? He was in
right.
in Pulp Fiction, a bunch of other movies.
Yes,
he's the he's playing the Paul Ekman role in the show. And basically, you know, it, like a lot of these other shows, the Profiler shows, again, pure woo for the moo audience. Moo for the woo. And woo for the moo. Showing this stuff, again, you can't put a fork in it because it's observational. It happens very quick. We talk about it in our terms as a four-second window. It's a little ping you do with the surroundings every 4 seconds. Your brain does it for you. And that's called the social cognitive loop. And basically, if you feel safe, then everything proceeds as planned. If you feel a little threatened, then you start to change the way that you move and the way that you express yourself to get yourself to a safer ground in the next little four-second window. And the funny part is these four-second windows are independent. So they're like raindrops hitting the sidewalk. They're not sequential. So they don't have a way to temporally summate. So that's one of the things that people make in terms of reading body language. It's always happening in the moment, in the moment, in the moment. That's why we call it profiling, taking slices or little image snapshots of people, and you're forming associations with it. Now, we had fancy guests like, Sherry Florence comes to mind. She talks about opticoding with pictures as opposed to lexicoding with words. We have a lot of people talk of fancy stuff on the show. I mean, you know, they sat down and wrote, like, really in-depth books about it. But we don't want to go that far to that level this year, introducing him to even more complicated stuff than what we know. We want to make them accountable to what we do. And what we do is very freaking simple. Actually, it's beyond simple. It's freaking insanely simple. It's because, of course, we have to share it with the public, which has the attention span of a ballless monkey. You know? So that's our problem. So we want to get into a little bit. Now, most people get into the body language biz, as we say, for the initiated. There's two reasons why anyone gets interested in learning body language, and Val, you can offer that out. You know the fill in the blank on this, right?
What's that?
Why do people look at body language at all? What's the two industries that...
The two industries? I don't know if they're industries. Two things. They want to either get paid or get laid.
Right. There you go. So you got the sales force out there, the corporate types learning body language so they can close a sale, and you've got everyone between the ages of 18 and 79 trying to get over. So they try to, you know, use it to recuse and for courting behavior, as they call it. And it leads to all sorts of disasters and all sorts of wasted websites and all sorts of infomercials and all kinds of crap, really. And we want to get some of these guys on there. Like, I want to get the speed seduction guy on there. I want to get him on the show because a lot of the stuff they're talking about, it sort of kind of rises from the ooze of NLP and some of the other things that came out to study human behavior in sort of a filtered way. And that led to a lot of these common body language myths that we're going to get into here to kind of just get you started to understand that we're going to shift your perceptions from the outside to the inside, just like this guy dangling from the ski. You know, if you're him, that is a horribly traumatic event. Everybody's snapping pictures. If you're not him, kind of funny. But if you're eco like us, you shrug your shoulders and you go, oh, planet Earth, unfair. And you don't really get surprised by it. So because you expect things to happen on planet Earth that are, humiliating and humbling. You're here. You're on the Earth. You will be humbled. Eventually, even the people that took the pictures and laughed will eventually fall on their ass and have a problem. And it kind of has a way of evening things out. But let's just start out. We're going to go through the myths. I'll read them through. And then we'll go over each one, and we can go chop them up as we go, right? The first big one that we can get to here, as far as like the one that's the most common one you're going to find, is called the 738-55 rule, right? And this is one that gets used way too much in the NLP circles and some of the other ones that talk about nonverbal behavior, especially with your sales staff, people who do public speaking. And basically that comes from the, I forget how to pronounce this guy's name. It's M-E-H-R-A-B-I-A-N, Mahalarabin's rule, okay? I can't say his name, the nonverbal pronunciation of that. And the rule is that 7% of the communication is verbal, 38% comes from facial expression, 55% from body gestures, right? And it's not really what they're talking about here. That we will generalize that to all communication when, in fact, that ratio only really matters when you're dealing with interpersonal communication, especially emotional stuff. So the literal quote was that, but that's that rule, okay? We'll go into the rule more in depth in a minute, all right? The next thing, the next big myth, I guess you want to call it, in the body language community is that your competency, your confidence and your competency is reflected between your verbal and nonverbal congruency. That's a big myth.
Mm-hmm.
People think you have to talk in visual gestures to make visual sayings and all that stuff. Okay, is that the second myth? Right? Then they start going rapid fire. This gets into the world of deception. Right? A liar can't look you straight in the eye. There's another myth. All right? When meeting someone,
I've been lied to to the eye.
The lie. When meeting someone, the more eye contact, the better. There's another myth. All right? Putting your hands behind your back is a power gesture. All right? Steepling your fingers shows that you're intellectual. Another myth. All right? Next one. High-status people demonstrate their dominance of others by touching them. There's another myth. Next one. People smile when they're happy. Rico, you know what that means. Okay, a couple more. Voices rise when speakers are angry. All right, another generalization. And the last one, you can't trust a fast-talking salesman. It sounds like my mother wrote that one. All right. So a lot of this stuff has to do with generalization and talking out of context. And that's one of the things we want to get to on the show because we have an opportunity to kind of clarify some of these things and going back to that first one, you heard that one, the whole thing about most communication, 93% of communication is nonverbal, 7% is words.
Sure.
Yeah, okay. Well, what they don't tell you is what the actual research was. And the way that got generalized was that NLP took a lot of these things, neuro-linguistic programming, and put them into that computerized kind of neurocognitive model, and they forgot the soma, the body that's doing the expressing. They made it all brain stuff. All right, so the way it really goes is, in terms of the way he says, this is a note from this guy's research, it's Mahararam's research, right? Please note that this and other equations regarding relative importance of verbal and nonverbal messages were derived from experiments dealing with communication of feelings and attitudes. In other words, like or dislike. Unless a communicator is talking about their feelings or attitudes, these equations are not applicable. So it only matters for emotional communication, which gets back to the whole concept of emotional intelligence and being able to read people empathically, and gets into a whole bunch of whole side streets with that. All right, so put that myth down. That's like the use 10% of your brain crap that's out there. It's such a it creates a lot of gaps in communication that don't need to be there, and it's a big body language myth, because what happens is people stop listening because they just figure, I'll just tune into someone's voice tone, or I'll tune into someone's body gestures or their facial expression, and I'll listen to what they're saying. Well, that's not communication. What the heck are they talking for? You've got to link those two. But now the best thing about being able to understand that myth is there, you don't have to go crazy chasing that dog, is the second myth about having to match your verbal skills with your nonverbal skills. All right, this comes from a book called A Leader's Voice. Great stuff. Right? Basically, what you're communicating on is three channels. Right? Factual, emotional, and symbolic. FES. And the authors there, these two shapes, Clark and Crossland. Right? You're demonstrating how to get your leadership across by being able to use all three channels. Most of us just use one. Right? And that's the talent. Only 15%, this is what these guys say, it's great, only 15% of what you say has to do with your competency about what you're talking about. The rest of it, more than 80% of it, has to do with being able to speak in the terms that reaches the ears of the audience. So you have to speak in their map, not yours. And you have to communicate in those three channels, facts, emotions, and symbols. Now, if you know your audience is mostly egos like us, then the emotional content, the passionate part of the voice tones, all that stuff, would be what you want to use to get your messages across, right? But if you're communicating to a bunch of maybe, I don't know, rexosauruses, exos, they would need to have the facts emphasized. So you got to be able to play that xylophone. And then the symbolic part gets into deep meaning and things like that. That's when you're getting into archetypal conversations and things like that. Maybe your philos and your ontos and your belief system stuff. You know, like if I say, you know, Jesus was an eco, which means nothing to you, you just say Jesus, period, people react because Jesus is a symbol, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that linking of nonverbal to verbal only matters when you don't know what the audience has on the other side of the coin. It all has to be two-way. A lot of body language myths are formed because they either focus on the person that's speaking or the person that's listening, not the conversation as a whole. All right, so you got the two myths. You got the percentage thing, and you got the matching between verbal and nonverbal. All right, so we got those two knocked down, and it's only 9:28. We got eight more myths. Any freaking calls? Absolutely not, right?
Wait, let me look. Nope.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't think so. All right, so the two biggest obstacles, I guess, to getting people into this conversation is that you have to be able to focus on what's going on inside yourself while you're also registering what's going on around you, and that is where you get into some of these things that we talked about before with the deception, right? And how that affects your communication, right? So the liar can't look you straight in the eye is the next one, the third one here, right? And again, we get back to Ekman, who's featured on this show, the Lie to Me show, right? He's looking at micro expressions that leak out of your face, the subtle emotional cues that will give you away. It's like in poker, they call them a tell, you know, when someone can see through it. Now, you know from, you know, doing a lot of work with students, like, think of a student trying to give you an excuse for not doing an assignment.
Ugh.
9:29. I almost threw up. 9:29, the first ugh of 2009. There you go. Yeah.
I'm still getting emails from the end of the semester. Arguing about their grades. There you go.
Yeah.
I can't stand it.
Another one. It's the second one. So it's like there's a nonverbal communication right there. Okay, when you tune into people and the way that they communicate, one of the things that we're going to get into as we go through some of these myths is you can always detect disgust, things like that. Okay, so the thing about looking the person in the eye, straight in the eye, right? This comes from Ekman's work, is that a lot of times when someone's a pathological liar, they'll look you straight in the eye, and they have no problem because, as the Costanzaism here, if we can snag it, from Seinfeld says.
Jerry, just remember, it's not a lie if you believe it.
There you go. You still there?
No.
Oh, okay. So how do you really learn to make that distinction? And a lot of times you're guessing because you're looking for things that are dead giveaways, right? So Ekman's book talks about telling lies. It's called Clues to Deceit in the Marketplace, Politics, and Marriage. It's three little things you don't see together very much. When we asked people how they would tell if someone was lying, squirming, and shifty eyes were the winners, but the clues that everyone knows about that involve behavior can be readily inhibited. Because you're going to know that they're going to be looking at your eyes. Right? Again, now you're in a two-way conversation with both an inside and an outside. So if you're aware that someone's watching your nonverbal cues, you inhibit them. So they won't be very reliable, right? So he says people get too invested in that, and if someone is a practiced sociopath, so to speak, they can shut that stuff off.
Yeah, I've known a few.
Oh, yeah. And so now the next one that piggybacks on that, when meeting someone, the more eye contact, the better. People say it's a long-held belief that, you know, if a shifty-eyed person's a liar, then someone who looks you directly in the eye is being honest. And the result sometimes is that, especially if you're staring in the eye of, say, well, I don't know, Hillary Clinton, you do not want to look in the – it's like that old rule, don't look into the sun.
Exactly.
That applies to ontosapes. Because when you look an onto in the eye, they take that as a challenge, and you can be very quickly you can be in a conflict. So that's where that 4-second window comes in, because most people can only maintain eye contact for about 4 seconds. 1 to 7 is sort of the range, 4 being the average. If you stare at someone for more than 4 seconds, you're either going to be going on a date or you're going to be having a fight. You know, so that's why that just that cross cultural thing. It's a biological cue that someone is engaging with you for longer than what's comfortable, right? You like to move around. So, and especially like in interviews, things like that, you don't want to stare at the person because they take that as almost as if it's like you're challenging them, almost like you're confronting them. So even with flirting, prolonged eye contact early in the process is a little bit like ogling.
That's right. Yeah, 2 or 3 seconds, you really have to look away, and then you can look back.
Otherwise, it's a lap dance, and then everything, then the rules don't apply.
Nope. That's about it.
So, okay, so there's now we got 4 of these things in the house, and you're putting them together. You're starting to see how things move around, right? Looking at the eyes, distance, all the gesture stuff. Now you get to the next one, power gestures. Putting your hands behind you is a power gesture. People think when they sort of, you know, don't show the hands, you know, it's a martial art thing. When you greet someone in martial arts, you put your hands in front and bow, saying, like, I'm not going to fight you, I have no weapons, you know, hands behind your back, it's like, you know, I don't have to show you nothing, kind of a thing. And people get taught this, especially in the corporate world, right? But the research, again, most people think this gesture is a gesture of untrustworthiness, so not power, and it makes you more suspicious. So if your goal is to increase trust, don't put your hands behind your stinking back, right? In fact, if you put your hands over the front of your body, you are communicating this message. Eventually.
Welcome back. Let's begin with a review of Tape 4's Vocabulary Builder. Watch and repeat. I am closed. I am open. There are so many thoughts in my head that it needs support. I am at rest, standing as if lying down. I am stimulating my thinker. Our usefulness is in suspension. Literally, we can't give you a hand. I am attuned to the passage of time. My genitals are unavailable.
There you go.
My boom boom is unavailable. Good.
Did you hear that part?
My boom boom is unavailable?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, anyway, we just snagged that on YouTube. But the whole point is that the placement of your hands is another myth. And people get too obsessed with it. And then what happens is that you get self-conscious about it. Now you're not communicating to them. You're communicating to yourself. And again, it puts another visible wall between you and the other person. And in your effort to communicate something of power, you're actually communicating something of suspicion. So it works against you. All right, so that's another big myth we just kind of knocked down. The next one, again, staying with the fingers and the hands, steepling of the fingers. When people do this, especially when you're doing things in an interrogation type of thing or a negotiation situation where you're trying to be smart, you see people do that, but they make the little steeple with their hands.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The speech coaches teach you to do this, right? And again, you're trying to play the part rather than be yourself, and that's when you get to be phony, right? So what happens is that they do this. They do all the gestures. They stroke the chin. They put the fingers on the cheek. It's, oh, I'm being very intellectual, right? I'm stimulating my thinker. And all those little emblems that you do, it makes you seem like you're trying too hard. And so in the act of trying to look smart, you look really stupid. And people go to those things thinking that it's going to conceal what they don't want the other person to know. It actually gives you away. It's like, that's why in poker they call it a tell. It's a dead giveaway. The only one that doesn't know it isn't in on the joke is you. Again, because they're watching for it. Especially when your intellect is being challenged. And if you start doing that stuff, it's like, I'm stalling. I don't know. I'm putting up a facade, or they call it an emblem, right? So there's another myth. Now, if we get a little deeper, now we start talking about status, right? Because high-status people demonstrate their dominance of others by touching them. And you know the people that are grabby, touchy, and they get in your personal space, they're actually trying to do the opposite. They're trying to bond with you because the phylo, as we get into domains here in a couple minutes, is always going on. Whatever they touch with, they bond. So they're actually trying to create a connection with you, a physical connection with you. And the message that they're trying to send is, I'm more powerful than you, because I can walk over and put my hand on you, right? And so this is another one of those things that gets tossed around. So there's another research role here about in a detox clinic, right? So people have been treated for alcoholism, right? So you're trying to set a status, right? A kind of role play, right? There's two clear trends. First, women on the average initiate more touches than men, and touching tends to flow upwards, not downwards in the hierarchy. All right, so it's the complete opposite of what you would be told on the speech coaches. These speech coaches are going to be taken back and shot in the head because they're doing everything backwards of what's actually out there. So the society belief would be that men do the touching, actually women do the touching, and the people that are lower on the totem pole initiated more than the people higher on the totem pole. So there you go. There's another one turned on its ear. So we're knocking them down. So now we get into some more facial stuff, right? People smile when they're happy. Smiling is innate. Infants do it. They have nothing to do with emotion. The first smile appears at 2 to 12 hours at the birth. It's another bonding mechanism. Second phase of smiling begins between the fifth week and 4 months. It's a social smile. It has nothing to do with mood. Okay? Now, when you get into motivation and courtrooms and things like that, like when a judge looks at a guy that's on trial, he's equally likely to find a smiler or a non-smiler guilty. All right? They give smilers lighter penalties. The phenomenon's called Though courtroom judges are equally likely to find smilers and non-smilers guilty, they give smilers lighter penalties.
Interesting.
Because it's social, see? So there you go. So that's another one. Like I said, so when you're smiling, it's another one of those things where you're doing it automatically as a social gesture because you're a social sape. You're not isolated. You're not a single skull. Your system is always trying to bond with others. Even though you might not want to bond with that particular individual, biologically you're drawn to do it. And the smile is there as a way to, again, it's another one of those things to say, I'm not an enemy. I'm not trying to attack you. It's a way to kind of soften the connection, because if you give them a flat face or you give them a, nothing to read on it, again, you look suspicious, right? So you smile. And sometimes people have that nervous smile. It's nothing to do with them being happy. It's that they feel threatened and they'll smile. Actually, in that movie Gran Torino, they talk a lot about that whole culture, the Hmong culture, which, you know, the Mongolians that were called Hmong, the Hmongs, they when they're nervous, they smile more. You know, nothing to do with being happy. Actually, I'm feeling threatened, and I smile more. I mean, so it's paradoxical, right? There's another one knocked down. So we're slipping through them here. Now, voices rise when the speaker gets angry. There's another one that the generalization, if I'm getting loud, I must be mad. No. It's a nonspecific, right? A rising voice associated with a variety of emotions, including anger, but also nervousness, fear, excitement, hysteria, and others. So, again, you're back to context. If I'm trying to make a point and I'm passionate about it, I'm not angry, I'm excited. And if you generalize that, every time you hear a loud voice, you think anger, you, the listener, goes into tune out, right? When, in fact, the communicator is trying to get you to tune in and emphasize, and if they're not using that leadership voice and they're not sensitive to the other person's interpretation of their signal, they continue to get passionate, and they spook the person. And the classic example, if you've ever been to one of these motivational talks, is that you roll in there in the morning, you know, crack of ass, and they put on the stinking Rocky music, and they're running around on the stage like Tony Robbins, and they're like, you know, everybody, hey, for a great day! And they're like, I can't hear you. And it's a total mismatch. Now, they're trying to get you jump-started, get you into what they're doing, but they're not matching the pace of the audience's map, so they're not leading you anywhere. They're trying to force you somewhere. And that always distances you or turns you off to the speaker. And the rest of the day, you're going, this jerk off doesn't even know him. It's 7 in the morning. Just go come in quiet, man. Like we do. Hello. Like that.
Yeah, you're always quiet.
Yes, I'm very quiet. Tippy-toe. It beats it can tell.
Oh, Lord.
So that kind of springboards into the next one, the fast-talking salesman, right? Everyone associates speed with deception, right? The faster I talk, the more I must be full of shit, right? So the rapid patter of Professor Hill and the Music Man, the FedEx guy, you know, talking fast, all those things are classic examples, right? People talk an average rate of 125 to 225 words per minute, right? When you get to the upper level of that range, then you start resisting, right? But the opposite causes suspicion. You talk slower and have more pauses, then people start going, what the frick is going on? And that's a big indicator of deception because you're not getting the flow of conversation is being disrupted. So fast leads to resistance. Slow leads to being perceived as being deceptive. So it's the trust part of the fast-talking salesman has nothing to do with trust. It's you can't process what they're saying because they're talking too freaking fast. But when they talk slower and they're more accurate and they talk at that low end of the range, it's like they don't know what they're talking about, they're not sure, they're fishing for answers, you start getting more suspicious. This is natural. Okay? So there's your myths. Zip through them all. Now, some of these safes I found here online looking around for stuff, they had some good little insights here about reading people's body language, which I want to get into here. We've got a couple minutes left, then we're going to get into some domain talk, because we have to, because that's what we do here.
That's right.
Yeah, goddammit. All right. Now, this Alan Sape, what the heck is his name again?
Alan Shoreland. Shoreland?
Yeah.
You know, every
website?
Time I see that word, never mind.
Yeah, sure, it sounds like short, yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
I had to
fault.
Look twice the first time. I'm like, wait, what?
Yeah, he's on communicationandconflict.com. And he's got a nice little line here. He says, it is a seductive idea to think that we can know what people are thinking and feeling without having to actually speak to them and ask them. Sometimes connecting with people by speaking to them can be very threatening and intimidating. It may be someone we have a strong dislike of or someone we have a strong attraction to. In the latter example that we talk about here with speculation, when you interpret someone's body language, sometimes you're only doing things that count for what you would want to say and not letting them get their voice in. So his concern here is that when you're striving to be present with someone and then you're also looking for all these little cues and little things, you're actually disconnecting from them and reducing them to most sort of a three-dimensional version of these concepts instead of actually connecting with them in the flow and putting your that 7%, the words, to work. And asking questions and being a listener and being a speaker, not just being an observer that's trying to hide behind a lot of this stuff, happens a lot in NLP, happens a lot especially in the legal profession because you're a witness and your statements are being analyzed as they're coming out of your mouth. So it's less of a conversation, it's more of an interrogation. You don't want to do that in everyday life.
You know, what gets me crazy is somebody will always come to me and say, oh, can you help me with something? And then they'll tell me the story about somebody and say, what do you think they're doing, or what do you think they wanted, or so on and so forth? And I'd always say, did you ask them? No.
No.
They never want to do that. They want me to guess instead. And my answer is always, you need to ask them. I'm not going to guess what they're thinking. How the hell would I know?
Yeah, people tend to want to take a shortcut or find their way under the radar because it brings up the conflict. It brings up, like you said, those strong feelings of like or dislike, which cause you to tune into the nonverbal stuff more because the words are what you're trying to avoid. You don't. It's like, you know, tell me what I want to hear. Don't tell me what I don't want to hear. The truth is going to freaking hurt. Tell me something a little less intense that I can deal with, right? So how do you get around it? How do you get to be present with someone and not get preoccupied with it? Rebecca Shafir wrote in her book, The Zen of Listening, great little take on this, and we talk about it in the little ebook we have on the website called The S-List. It's this idea of having a cinematic perception of reality. We call it somatic cinema, and she calls it the movie mindset. So just like when you're at the movies, when you forget yourself, you forget that you're sitting in the theater, and you put yourself in the shoes of the speaker, you kind of meld with the screen, right? Your body relaxes into more listening posture. And when you're truly listening, you're not thinking about your body. You're not thinking about what you should be doing with your hands. Your gestures are effortless. And then you're really having an engaging conversation. It's when you're trying to measure those things and almost kind of mechanically, almost act your way through it, that you look freaking phony. And then all your intent seems to go the other direction. Like put the hands behind the back to be powerful? No, now you look suspicious. Raise your voice because you want to communicate something powerful, and they think that if you raise your voice, you're angry. All those things, you know, the touching thing we talked about, people low on the totem pole do the touching, not the ones higher on the totem pole. They get touched. You know, it's all backwards. So playing this game becomes sort of almost self-deception in a way, because you're trying to pick up deception in somebody else, and you're deceiving yourself. So that's what he gets into here. So he says his suggestion here is that you can never know if you're correct or not about some of these interpretations. Your job is to let go of the prejudgment and stop trying to formalize them and promote better communication and connection between you and somebody else. So like the old thing in the legalese is that someone's lying if they're looking up to the left with their eyes, or they're looking up to the right, they're getting more creative, right? And in NLP, actually, you're going into construct and you're making up a story if you look up to the right and you're remembering something, you're up to the left. So the neurology is even wrong. It gets crazy. And like I said, then you deal with cultures that, like Japanese or some of the more Eastern cultures, the language centers, they're both right and left brains, so their eyes are always up when they're thinking of what to say. And, you know, it matters a lot if someone has auditory problems. Some people are more visual learners. There's a zillion things that could be. Well, you don't know why they're doing it.
That's right.
But the soma knows.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And even those the dopey tests, like that the one that you shrinks used, that Minnesota multiphasic personality
thing. I never used it. I did Freudian stuff. I didn't use that crap. I went right for the testicles.
No, well, it's all your mother. So. You know, at the end of the day, the only emotions that you could pick up without a lot of training is happiness, sadness, disgust, and fear. Those are easy to pick up. Everything else is sort of a guess. But you can be trained to look at some of these minimal cues, some of the things Ekman talks about, and you can be more accurate about it, but you can never know no unless you confirm it with a verbal. So the nonverbal stuff is there to get a better clue, but then you got to go and confirm the clue, and people don't. They just take it as, you know, on the surface, and they don't check with the person that's sending that signal, because 95% of them, they're not even aware that they're sending you the signal.
No.
Okay? So there you go. There's all your shocking information there about body language. I might toss some of the stuff up around the blog somewhere if I get a chance. There's a lot of good, interesting stuff. But basically, two sides of the coin. One side says it can be learned. One side says it's innate. One side says that you can't know anything from reading the signs, and some people say you can teach yourself to look at these micro expressions and get better and better at more accurate. But again, the common denominator is it's a conversation. It isn't just about reading them and not being able to perceive yourself and what you're trying to extract, which brings us to profiling and what we do in the somatic method, right? And how we get our message across to you here on the blog talk, of course, is to babble into the phones here and sort of attempt to, ooh, that almost went in, to kind of get A to B without, you know, really trying to mince words. Self and surroundings is the basis of semantics, right? We got that established? It isn't just you. It's the environment in you, right?
Right.
And there's an environment within you, and there's an environment around you, okay? And those interactions are what you're basically sort of the mediator of, right? So when you're going through development, you're shifting your perceptions of those interactions as you get a more complex nervous system. So when you start the conversation, it starts with anything outside me that's like me. The baby conversation, the first year of life, is mommy, 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 where's mommy? And it's all about bonding. So all of your attempts to interpret anything that goes on around you has to do with finding mommy and feeling safe. And that becomes the philosomatic language of expression, which has to do with touch, has to do with intimate connection, very narrow spatial differences. So you're right in your face between, you know, right on the surface and about a foot and a half away, that intimate space, the close talkers out there. They will be your philos. And we talk a lot of this all in detail going on and on, but that's the general idea. Then something magical happens the second year of life. You say, F everybody else, it's all about the conversation in myself. So you tune out the other and tune into the conversation within yourself, and you go on what you're thinking and what you're seeing and what you're having in your head. And you don't want any help, and you don't want mommy. You want you, you, you. And you become very territorial. And that's the self-referencing ontosomatic conversation. So now you got two conversations going in two different directions in the first 2 years of your life. And that's 80% of the population thinks that that's the only conversation that's going on, is those two. And then you have that third year of your life, the eco. During the eco year, you tune into the surroundings and forget about self and other. So that's why something as simple as temperature of a room or lighting or all the other atmospheric conditions that can go on in a room can affect your ability to communicate and can impair your ability to recognize some of these other cues because you're so preoccupied with the temperature or the light or the comfort or the texture, all these other things that are going on that are internally interpreted, internal feelings, not external feelings. And you have a tendency to be very empathic because your emotional channels are open. Again, we're talking about facts, emotions, and symbols. You're going on your emotional interpretation of what's going on, not just the perception, the sensory motor stuff, like before, or not just the thoughts you have about it, but now you're awaiting those thoughts. And so then you arrive at the car garage of the somas, the exosomatic world of the four-year-old, who now can do all these things that are happening in space, but they can do them in time. So they have a memory from the past, they have the present information to match it up with, and they have their intent, which means by 4 years old, you can do what? Lie. Lie, 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 like a son of a bitch. Because all it is, it's the shell game. You got the past, the present, and the future. You just keep mixing them around. Whatever one you feel interprets best becomes your agenda, and then you lock it into your worldview, and you try to inflict it on others. And now, all skate. You're in society. There you go. There's your 4 years, the first 4 years of your life. So one of those 4 years, you sat there in the somatic cinema and went, I get this the best. That's me. That's my closed identity. And you develop behavior patterns, communication habits, styles of being able to walk and position yourself and spatially distance yourself from others and word phrases, a whole bunch of things that, you know, believe me, you don't even want to know them. There's so many of them. They're called signatures. And those are the things that you form your closed identity of until you're 25 years old, and then your brain goes, thank you, tip your waitresses, biology's done. The rest of it's all social. And the other three that you eschewed, that you put in the secondary part of your identity, now becomes your support system for the primary. But, you've been ignoring these things for the most part. So where are you going to get them from? Ain't going to be from you. It's going to be from them, those shapes you've been ignoring. Now, if you're a philo, like a lot of you, you've been ignoring the inside of you and been focusing on the outside of them, which is why you believe a lot of these body language myths. And you go to some training or some Toastmasters thing and put your hands behind your back. And they put you in acting class and you're not naturally able to communicate. The ontos, of course, say, F it, I'll do what I want. And the ecos are looking for, like, you know, if there's any food in the back, that kind of thing. And the exos are just checking for spelling errors in the brochure. Right? So So this whole thing becomes like almost like it almost fits, because now you can start to see people not in their personality mode, not in their sort of the generic sort of way of kind of being, but you see them as a living system, and you see them as a what? As a living object that you can then subjectively sense, and you can figure out what the person is, and then where they're communicating from. So where he goes, me and Val, right? But we've been talking really exo tonight, very factually, right?
Mm-hmm.
Every once in a while, we slip into eco mode and we get a little emotional, right? But we're not being very symbolic. We're not talking about things in terms of one particular point of view. We're not trying to, you know, we're not trying to get over on some belief system on you, because we frankly couldn't give a rat's ass.
No.
But you, on the other end, probably do, because there's Antos out there listening to this, and there's Philos out there listening to this that live in the archetypal universe, because that's all they want to process. They want to get the, you know, the satellite photo of this. And we're trying to get you to get the emotional sense of it, because that's where we're coming from. So maybe that's our little bridge to cross, Charlie, is to make this much more factual, but also use the symbols to make it so it's colorful. But I think our pattern has been to present the facts and the emotions and not give you the symbols to hang on to. So if you want a little going out the door, why don't we give them the animal eyes to work on this week and see if they can go out and soma spot that. So go through from starting with the Philos, looking at people's eyes in pictures and also in your interactions. You were looking for what kind of eye for a Philo, Val?
You're looking for either the, like a puppy dog eye or a doe eye, a real soft kind of eye that brings you toward them.
Mm. Yeah, and, you know, I'll give you just an example to look at a Mickey Mouse. Right? You're looking for someone that feels receptive, safe, and usually socially subordinate to you. The Philo
mm-hmm.
wants you to feel superior. They want you to feel like you can protect them. Now, that doesn't matter, male or female. Right? Will Smith. Big time Philo, okay? Look at his eyes. Believe me, like a puppy. Right in. All right, next one. Antos. What animal is that?
that would be the tiger.
Yeah.
The tiger eye. The drilling eye that goes through your head and melts your brain.
Yes. And again, the Anto is a predator. It, because they're perceiving themselves. Again, we talked about before, they're not tuned into the physiology of the other person, and they're referencing themselves. So their eyes are looking for targets. They're looking for whatever it is their mind is searching for outside the environment. And if they find you, you'll feel it burning in your forehead, right? So the tiger eyes. And believe me, they lock in on you. And when you look at them and you try to do that look at them too long thing with the eye contact thing, your eyes begin to burn. You know you're looking at an Anto.
Oh, yeah.
And by knowing that, you know a lot about that person in that moment, and you can identify yourself as saying, okay, they're coming from their belief system. I have to talk in terms of archetypal language. I got to talk symbolically with them, because if I get them facts and those facts don't match, you're going to get the horns. All right? So that's 80% of the population, bunch of puppies and a bunch of tigers. Now, rounding the horn, ecos, 11% of the population, our eyes are like what?
Like Mr. Ed.
There you go. The horse eye. You ever have a conversation with a moth? That is an eco. They're emotionally there, but only temporarily. So you're talking
mm-hmm.
to a moving target. You're talking to someone who's sort of in a trance-like state. They're kind of between inside and outside. They're sort of with you and around you and kind of in the room with you, but they're not really kind of settled. So you get that horse eye look. A lot of times they won't look you directly in the eye because they're darting around. Again, you think that would promote mistrust, but actually they're searching for information. So be patient with the ego. Give them an extra couple of seconds to come back with that information, because they're going through a lot of channeling. Again, those filters come in. The emotional blank languaging comes in for them. Finally, the exos are the what?
Shark.
Yes, the shark eye. Like a doll's eye.
Yeah, like a doll or shark, yeah.
There's basically no connection. The eye looks almost dead. And it looks like a digital eye. It looks like an eye that's basically identifying you like it would identify the couch or a book or a door or anything else. And
wow,
it
we only
really,
have 20 seconds. Holy cow.
Doesn't
God.
Really engage with you. Yeah, okay.
Right.
So there you go. I don't know what the hell we just did, but that's our first hour. We will see you next week on this time and station. Thank you for joining us in this time and your space. This is Dr. Mark and Professor Val.
What the fuck?
Travel light.
Travel light to the darkness. That's right.
Bye-bye.
Portions of today's programming are reproduced by electrical transcriptions or tape recordings. Thank you.